A passel of pomp and a circus of circumstance. Historic convention coverage from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Every 4 years as summer ends, the United States turns its attention to two chosen cities. Why? The two cities play host to the two major political party conventions. But what goes on inside these conventions? And why in recent years has so much gone on outside the convention halls? I'm Amy Goodman. The Pacifica Radio Archives, the nation's largest public radio archive, comb through its vaults in an attempt to learn more about the history of party conventions and to also learn how the Pacifica Radio Network covered these conventions over the years. In the last hour, we left off in Chicago, 1968. Violence ensued outside the convention halls, and a great dissatisfaction with the Democratic candidate was felt inside. As a result, the Democratic Party sought to find another way to choose a candidate, one less controversial. And so, under the leadership of George McGovern, a commission came up with the primary election. This would allow a candidate to be determined before anyone ever set foot inside a convention hall. Any controversy would take place miles and miles away. And so in 1972, in Miami, both the Republicans and the Democrats meet in this city, both using the same primary election system. The third-rate burglary at the Watergate was a little more than 2 months old when the Republicans meet in Miami to reaffirm President Nixon in August. The convention is carefully and literally scripted. It's designed to give Nixon the best possible exposure, with almost no worries as to whether Nixon and Agnew will be reelected in November. It is a passel of pomp and a circus of circumstance. Everyone moves through the motions. Nixon and Agnew are nominated. Then Nixon takes the stage and turns to the one issue to which he is sensitive in the field of foreign policy.
Standing in this convention hall 4 years ago, I pledged to seek an honorable end to the war in Vietnam. We have made great progress toward that end. We have brought over 500,000 men home, and more will be coming home. We have ended America's ground combat role. No draftees are being sent to Vietnam. We have reduced our casualties by 98%. We've gone the extra mile. In fact, we've gone tens of thousands of miles trying to seek a negotiated settlement of the war. We have offered a ceasefire, a total withdrawal of all American forces, an exchange of all prisoners of war, internationally supervised free elections with the communists participating in the elections and in the supervisions. There are things, however, that we have not and that we will not offer. We will never abandon our prisoners of war.
Although Nixon felt he was doing well enough on the Vietnam issue, just outside the convention hall, thousands gathered to protest the president, the system, the delegates, and the war. Pacifica reporters Mad Dog Lebowski and Gavin Duffy put together this post-convention show, Bad Moon Over Miami.
Delegates, you win. Let's block that gate up so nobody can get in that gate.
As you ride into town, Mrs. Nixon, you will see signs all along the way saying you're in Nixon country.
One of the convention delegates has been sprayed with red paint.
There's only one burlesque house, and that's the Gaiety Theater in the whole city of Miami Beach.
And none of the Republicans are coming down here.
That's right.
You have any idea why?
We have the Queen of Burlesque here. This Tempest Storm, and if that can't bring him in, nothing we can do or say anything about
it. We're here to bring God back to America.
How do you want to end the Vietnam War? You think we should just kill him?
It's either kill him or be killed. In war, war is war.
It was nomination night, and Lester Lannan and his orchestra were swinging and swaying to the strains of Happy Days Are Here Again, as the Republican delegates were swooning over the personage of their fearless leader, Richard Nixon, who arrived at the poem Watery-Eyed. Watery-Eyed not so much because he was all choked up with emotion, but because he too was tear-gassed. Yes, happy days were there again, but only inside the convention hall under the glare of the television lights. The scene was much more macabre outside the hall under the glare of the bad moon over Miami.
convention delegates are coming back again, and there's a police escort here to take them in through the demonstrators. The convention delegates are now making their way through the demonstrators with a police escort.
Thinking,
you have to start thinking
as humans
being. They're not
human either. You have to think as a planet, not as Americans or Vietnamese.
You know, son, I was walking in the freedom marches back when you were in grammar school for crying out loud. And don't come in and tell me this racist stuff.
Florida Highway Patrol marching out towards 17th Street. Someone just threw a tear gas canister back at the police and it exploded in their lap. But the police are retaliating, and we seem to have a pretty sophisticated game of stickball going on. What has happened is demonstrators have been caught at either end of the street. The highway patrol has cut off Washington Street and making it impossible for demonstrators to move down Washington Street towards the convention hall, the front entrances to the convention hall.
You in purple trousers, is about that close? Thank you. Over this way. After line, back up.
The presidency of the Nixon administration will last a little less than 2 years. In 1974, Vice President Spiro T. Agnew will resign. On August 8, 1974, Richard Nixon will become the first president to resign his office. He will be succeeded by his chosen successor, Gerald R. Ford, the only man to have ever served as both vice president and as president without having been elected to either office.
Throwing tear gas, and once again, a retreat to the public parking facility. Police cars are moving in. Highway patrol chasing demonstrators down Washington Avenue.
Is Jimmy Carter inevitable? Inevitable. Inevitable.
This is the question Pacifica reporter Charles Bell asked on Pacifica station WPFW in early 1976. Bell had followed former Governor Carter on the campaign trail, reporting back his observations of the candidate.
Having seen him in action here and in Illinois, after talking with his staff and with members of the ever-increasing press contingent that follows his burgeoning campaign, I think perhaps he may be. A few things, at least, can be said for certain. Carter is a superbly effective campaigner, one whose style and whose message are uniquely suited to this particular era in American politics and society. And he is also a politician blessed with that most intangible but most important element in the construction of political success, luck.
As inconceivable as it was only months before, it seemed Charles Bell's prediction would come to pass. But what else contributed to Carter's rise? During the previous years, the news had been dominated by controversial court rulings, including the exoneration of Ohio Governor James Rhodes and 27 Ohio National Guardsmen in the shootings of 13 Kent State students in May 1970, as well as two landmark Supreme Court rulings in early 1973, the liberal decision of Roe v. Wade in January, and the conservative ruling by 6-3 in March, upholding a lower court ruling allowing states to outlaw homosexual acts, even if committed in private by consenting adults. According to the New York Times, in early 1976, joblessness in the Big Apple reaches 12.2%, The state of Massachusetts' unemployment rate hits 11.8%. In theaters across the country that spring, reflecting possibly the mood of the country, are Academy Award-nominated films One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Dog Day Afternoon, Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, and Taxi Driver, all films about someone bucking the system, doing it differently. And it seemed the country wanted someone different, too. In November, Carter takes the election. Despite his contagious optimism, not to mention the fact the Democrats control both the House and the Senate at the time of his election, Carter finds out the rules of insider Washington politics the hard way. Carter promised during the campaign to reduce arms production in the world, but during his presidency, arms production actually went up. Carter placed solar panels on the White House, but what the country remembers of his presidency is the OPEC energy crisis and the long, long lines at the pumps. In 1979, the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan, and of course, Iran takes 66 Americans hostage. By the time 1980 comes around, it seems the country again wants change. This time, replacing the independent outsider with someone who represents the influential insider world of money and politics, which would signify an entire decade.
Reagan was telling reporters today that he had considered for many long hours former President Ford as a running mate. Reagan says that it was Ford's decision that he could best help the party by not being a candidate, but a campaigner.
Pacifica reporter Wendell Harper.
It was Ford's instinct, says Reagan, not to become involved in a political battle for the presidential ticket. George Bush, on the other hand, is in the somewhat unusual position of having run against Reagan and now having to run with him. His platform seems to have changed quite a bit. He's no longer for the Equal Rights Amendment, as the women's movement had suggested, but he is now for, quote, equal rights. He's also anti-abortion. And Reagan added his own thoughts to the difference between the Equal Rights Amendment and the party's platform plank.
You see, there is no disagreement, and anyone who reads that plank in the platform recognizes that there has never been a more specific statement in support of equal rights than is in the Republican platform this year. The only difference of opinion that took place in framing the platform was one of how best to achieve equal rights, whether by statute and law or whether by amendment.
But reporters refused to let George Bush off the hook, recalling his denunciations of Reagan's proposed tax cut legislation.
Listen, let me enthusiastically support the proposal that Governor Reagan made in terms of taxes and that was introduced, incidentally, in the House by, we don't want to go back into when we were on opposite sides, but by Barbara Conable, the ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee, who strongly now, having failed in his support of it, but strongly supports Governor Reagan. And you look at that, and I see a tax bill and a tax proposal that has my enthusiastic support. And there are things in there that I strongly urge. And Governor Reagan had emphasis on other things. But the fact that we both recognize that cutting taxes is the way to help people and to stimulate production is the important thing. And please do not try to keep reminding me of differences I had. I want to get there on the same wavelength and go forward together, and that's what I'm going to do.
So what remains, it seems, is the question of what the far right will do now that Bush, the nominee they vehemently protested, is the nominee they're perhaps stuck with. But it seems pretty clear that unity is not the order at the moment for the Republican Party. For Pacifica, this is Wendell Harper at the Republican National Convention in Detroit.
During 1980, Pacifica hit its stride in covering party conventions with booths at both conventions and live coverage throughout each.
Mark, we have a tape up on the machine that will change the tone quite a bit, and we think maybe we'd share it with you now. It is Ralph Nader shortly after Three Mile Island having a few words to say about Jimmy Carter.
The question is not, can we find other ways to meet our electricity needs. The question is, can enough people in this country roll up their sleeves and go to work as citizens to mobilize an undeniable power that reverberates from California to New York and from Sacramento to Washington? The issue now is political. We were told in 1976 by candidate Jimmy Carter that he would never lie to us and never deceive us. You remember he called atomic energy the last resort. You remember he called he called solar energy and conservation of energy the first resort. Well, after watching him for almost 2.5 years, can we conclude other than he has deceived us? Has he deceived us? Has he lied to us? You remember what he told us when he raised those words? He said that if he ever deceives us and if he ever lies to us, he wants us to vote against him.
Pacifica's coordinated coverage that year took the listener from inside the convention walls to the likes of independent voices like Ralph Nader, but also to independent candidates like John Anderson, who in November will end up garnering nearly 7% of the vote.
And in related news, independent presidential candidate John Anderson came to New York City to make some news of his own. Anderson held a press conference this morning to announce that former Republican Party co-chair Mary Crisp would become his campaign chair.
This is the first time in American political history that a woman will be the chairperson of a presidential campaign. In the new post, which she assumes today, Mary Dent Crisp will assume a broad range of responsibilities in developing and implementing the strategy for the campaign.
Crisp resigned her post as Republican Party co-chair last month, and today she blasted the Republican Party for its stand on women's issues.
The Republican platform is outrageous. It is offensive to the majority of the American people. The abandonment of a 40-year commitment to the Equal Rights Amendment, the proposal of a constitutional amendment to ban abortion, perhaps even the most frightening proposal is the inference that to be appointed a federal judge requires an anti-abortion position.
That's about it for now. We go back up to the press area with Mark and Eileen.
United States James Earl Carter. This has got to be one of the president's happiest moments in a long time. Since November, the president has been in the hot seat. He's been attacked by Kennedy. Finally, before the Democrats tonight, he's number one.
With gratitude and with determination, I accept your nomination.
That would be Carter's last victory. In November, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush will soundly defeat Carter and Walter Mondale. In the year leading up to the 1984 presidential election, the odds looked good for the Democrats to unseat President Reagan. In 1982, during the midterm elections, Democrats won 75% of the governor's races and 60% of the congressional seats. Also in their favor is the nation's high unemployment rate, which had climbed steadily during Reagan's tenure, so much so that in July 1983, economic data shows the nation's unemployment rate is down to 9.8%, but unemployment among African Americans remains at 20.6%. On September 21st, 1983, Reagan's Interior Secretary, James Watt, defends his coal advisory commission makeup by saying, "I have a black, I have a woman, two Jews, and a cripple." Immediately, a storm of protest hits Watt, and he resigns his post on October 9th. Nearly a month after his resignation, on the 3rd of November, Jesse Jackson, coming from the opposite spectrum, declares his candidacy for the 1984 Democratic presidential nomination. He speaks of a rainbow coalition of blacks, Hispanics, women, the disabled, and other minorities who, he says, have been oppressed by the policies of the Reagan administration. In January 1984, Jesse Jackson, traveling as a private citizen, speaks with Syrian President Hafez Assad and obtains the release of U.S. Airman Robert Goodman Jr. Although initially applauded for his effort, it comes back to haunt Jackson later when he's criticized as being a loose cannon and someone who does not play by the rules. After March 13th, or Super Tuesday, the Democratic race is narrowed to two men, former Vice President Walter Mondale, who wins Georgia and Alabama, and Senator Gary Hart, who wins Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Florida. By the end of May, Walter Mondale is the clear favorite, having won Illinois, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, New Jersey, and West Virginia, with only two losses other than that first loss in New Hampshire. Washington, D.C., and Louisiana both go to Jesse Jackson. In July, Mondale, after securing his party's nomination, names Geraldine Ferraro to be his running mate.
Thank you, Vice President Mondale.
Making Ferraro the first woman to ever appear on a major party ticket.
Vice President, it has such a nice ring to it. I want to thank Fritz Mondale for asking the convention to nominate me as his running mate. This choice says a lot about him, about where the country has come, and about where we want to lead it.
And on July 17th, Jesse Jackson delivers a passionate speech at the DNC in San Francisco, which, according to Nielsen ratings, had the unusual effect of doubling his listening audience from the time he began his speech to when it ended 50 minutes later.
We come together, bound by our faith in a mighty God, with genuine respect and love for our country, and inheriting the legacy of a great party, the Democratic Party, which is the best hope for redirecting our nation on a more humane, just, and peaceful course. This is not a perfect party. We are not a perfect people. Yet we are called to a perfect mission. Our mission, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to house the homeless, to teach the illiterate, to provide jobs for the jobless, and to choose the human race over the nuclear race. Here this week to nominate a candidate and adopt a platform which will expand, unify, direct, and inspire our party and the nation to fulfill this mission. My constituency is the desperate, the damned, the disinherited, the disrespected, and the despised. They are restless and seek relief. They have voted in record numbers. They have invested the faith, hope, and trust that they have in us. From Fannie Lou Hamer in Atlantic City in 1964 to the Rainbow Coalition in San Francisco today, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, we've experienced pain but progress as we ended America's apartheid laws. We got public accommodations. We secured voting rights. We obtained open housing as young people got the right to vote. We lost Malcolm, Martin, Medgar, Bobby, John, and Viola. The team that got us here must be expanded, not abandoned.
Our time has come. Suffering breeds character. Character breeds faith. In the end, faith will not disappoint. Our time has come. Our faith, hopes, and dreams will prevail. Our time has come.
has endured for a night, but now joy cometh in the morning. Our time has come. No grave can hold our body down. Our time has come. No lie can live forever. Our time has come. We must leave racial battleground and come to economic common ground and moral higher ground. America, our time has come. We've come from disgrace to amazing grace. Our time has come. Give me your tired, give me your poor, your huddled masses who yearn to breathe free. And come November, there will be a change because our time has come. Thank you, and God bless you.
Despite the mood inside the convention hall and Jesse Jackson's prediction of their time has come, Ronald Reagan and George Bush will win the election in November by winning 49 of 50 states and 525 out of 538 electoral votes, thus securing the country 4 more years of Reaganomics. You're listening to A Passel of Pomp and a Circus of Circumstance, historic convention coverage from the Pacifica Radio Archives.